Good afternoon and welcome. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. My guest today is Amanda Littman. With Ross Morales, she co-founded Run for Something, an organization that since 2017 has helped thousands of young people run for public office at the local level. Littman was 27 years old when she started Run for Something. Now in her mid-30s, she's begun to notice that she was no longer the only young person heading organizations and companies like hers. She's also noticed that young leaders work differently than their baby boomer predecessors. Her new book is a manual for young leaders with advice on how to navigate the changing demands of running nonprofit and for-profit organizations. Drawing on her own experience of balancing her professional demands and the demands of motherhood and family, and in interviews with more than 100 Gen Z and millennial leaders, Littman provides a how-to guide to changing the paradigms for being the boss. It's called When We're in Charge, The Next Generation's Guide to Leadership. Amanda Littman joins me on Zoom from Brooklyn, New York to talk about it. Hey, Amanda, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Same. Thanks for having me, Tom.
And I really enjoyed your first book, Run for Something, and I enjoyed this book a lot as well. You say in this book that you don't have a dream job because you don't dream of labor. I think that's great. And we don't have dream jobs, but rather we have dream lives. A big part of this book deals with this so-called balance, this work-life balance. But you even change that paradigm. You don't even think it should be framed in that way. Talk about how you think it should be framed.
You know, I think we got to consider not just work-life balance, because, you know, we work most of our living hours, our waking hours, but work-rest balance. At this moment, work seems to infiltrate so many different corners of our lives, you know, between virtual or hybrid workplaces, the way that we can always be answering emails or Slacks or messages. We have to, as bosses, as leaders, set up better guardrails so that people can have a life outside of work and also get things done at work. It's not just about balancing them both. It's about balancing work and rest.
I have a friend who is, I guess, on the upper, in the upper quadrant of millennial, in mid-40s or so, who says that she doesn't manage her time. She manages her energy. And I always thought that was a really good way of looking at it, because it's not just about time, is it? It's not just about hours at work or not at work. It's about distraction and your and where your attention is.
That's exactly right.
And is that changing, do you think, overall, because there are more younger leaders now who are being, you know, the mantle's being passed?
I think so. I think we're seeing millennials and Gen Z take over companies, communities, cities, governments, all kinds of spaces, and say, actually, the way that we did things yesterday does not have to be the way we do things tomorrow, because the way that we were doing things yesterday didn't work for us. You know, I think about so many older leaders, and, you know, it's not exclusively, of course, but so many older leaders for whom the way that it was proof that you were getting things done was you were in the office 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week or 80 hours a week. And, you know, for millennials, especially in Gen Z too, like, we have seen our institutions crumble. We've seen layoffs. We've seen recessions. We've seen COVID. We've seen this stuff continually hit us to the point where we're like, what is all this hard work for? What is it serving? How, it doesn't seem to make a difference at the end of the day, whether I'm working 80 hours or 40 hours. Either way, I'm going to get laid off at some point. That makes it really hard to want to give it your all. And so we have to reimagine what it could look like for us. I think that's one of the things that young leaders are doing in all kinds of spaces in a way that will make a real transformative change to how people interact with each other, with work, with all of it.
And we should remind folks that the sort of textbook definition of a millennial is a person who's somewhere between the ages of about 29 and 44, roughly, right?
Ish. 30, you know, they're
40,
soft
45.
Boundaries.
Right. And Gen Z is as young as 13 and as old as maybe 28 or 29. Right. And there are people, you know, in their 20s who are starting things like you did with your colleague Ross Morales, and you know, or people who are taking over leadership positions at, you know, in their 20s. And But you say that not only do the millennial and Gen Z styles of leadership differ from baby boomers. It looks different, it feels different, it leads to different team cultures. But you also say that the boomers aren't just different; they've led badly. You're pretty harsh on boomers in this book. What do you think the biggest, misgivings for boomers are?
Not all boomers. I always feel like it's important to caveat this in the same way that not all millennials, not all Gen Z, no generation is a monolith. And I think that there is a certain mindset of what I call bad boomer leadership that thinks, mental health problems are complaining, that thinks therapy is a waste of time, that thinks you have to be in the office 40 hours a week in order to be productive, that thinks it's impossible to build real, interpersonal relationships over the internet. That errs on one side or the other of oversharing and giving too much of yourself, or being a beep-bop robot, not allowing for any humanity in the workplace. That's not to say that there aren't good things that boomers have done and that there aren't some traits of leadership that hold true across generations. But I think we have millennials and Gen Z taking charge and proving that, like, actually, that's not the most effective way, or it's not the way that gets you the best results. Especially right now, when especially by 2030, a majority of the workforce is going to be millennials and Gen Z. So it's just not going to last.
The book is When We're in Charge, The Next Generation's Guide to Leadership. The author is my guest, Amanda Lipman. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. So is it that the boomers have fallen short, and the reason you can assert that is that the proof is in the pudding? We haven't been as productive as we should be. We haven't been as successful. The companies haven't progressed the way they should. The nonprofits have not flourish the way they should. I mean, do you see that kind of justification for the assertion? And don't get me wrong, I'm not necessarily disagreeing with your assertion, but where's the proof of that?
Well, I'm not sure it's in the outcomes necessarily, in the way that the outcomes feel. They would argue they've been successful, which is probably true, in some ways, but like, is it a success if your job leaves you drained at the end of the day? Like, I think a lot about the articles I see over like Fortune magazine and Forbes that are like, work-life balance is a joke. This stuff, it doesn't matter. You got to give it your all. I'm like, does your wife, and it's usually, does your wife, do your kids, do your friends agree with that? Do they think that sacrifice was worth it? Like, I think about when you get to the end of your life, is it going to feel good to look back and know that you grounded out for a job for however long you had to and didn't have time or space to be a better partner, a better parent, a better citizen? I don't think so. So, I this is what my impetus for the book is, and along with my work at Run for Something too, is like, what if work didn't suck? What if our communities didn't suck? What if our government didn't suck? Actually, a better way is possible, and you don't have to sacrifice efficacy for it.
You say that being a good manager can make you a great leader, but you can also be a leader without having any direct reports. You're not necessarily it's not necessarily required for leadership to be a person with a title and a bunch of people who have to suck up to you. Is there in your mind, because I know in the business schools and stuff, they have entire courses about the difference between management and leadership. Is this how-to guide that you've written, which is a really great read, by the way,
Thank you.
is it about managing people and managing expectations and managing the culture of the organization, or is it about leading, and how do you see the difference if there is one?
I think it's a little bit of both. Management is a set of tactics, things like project management, decision models, how you can run communication norms, like how do you delegate out things or assign things out. All of that is part of management, and it's something that many leaders have to do as part of their role, whether their leadership is professional or in the personal capacity. But I think especially for younger folks who are thinking about things like becoming an influencer or a content creator or starting their own personal business, maybe they don't have direct reports, but they are leaders in a way. I think influencer is sort of like the one that is the most confusing to older folks and the most intuitive to younger ones. I've often heard the joke, like the dividing line is whether you think becoming an influencer is aspirational or embarrassing. For young people, it's aspirational. In fact, something like 57% of young people say that's a career goal of theirs. But you think about what an influencer does on the internet, okay? So an influencer posts content, builds community, creates trust, is their self, a version of themselves, in order to get their followers, literally the people that follow them on social media, to take an action. Usually it's to buy something, to like buy a thing they're hawking or a course they're selling, whatever it is. It's to get them to take action. That is the same thing that a politician does when they want people to vote. It's the same thing that a boss does when they want their team to do a particular project. That doesn't require managing people to get things done. It requires leadership. It requires showing vision. It requires building trust with folks. It requires laying out a way for people to get involved and giving them an opportunity and an easy way to say yes when you ask them to do something. It is a good leadership often has management, but you don't have to be a manager to be a good leader or a leader at all.
You mentioned authenticity, and this for me was one of the most fascinating parts of the book, because you say you've probably been told most of your life, just be yourself. You absolutely cannot be yourself, you are writing here, at least not fully, and not in the ways pop culture and social media tells us that authenticity looks like. So if you're a leader, you cannot, absolutely cannot be yourself. Explain that.
You know, this is something I have felt myself as a boss and a co-founder now for 8.5 years and managing teams for over a decade. And for so many of the people I spoke with for the book, who, you know, I spoke to politicians, I spoke to executives, I spoke to media editors in chief and teachers and faith leaders and camp directors. And to each one, I would ask them, tell me about your leadership style. And so many of them said, well, authentic, vulnerable. And then I would ask, do you feel like you can be yourself? And so many of them said, often with much more profanity, no. Because you can't. When you're in charge of, especially in the work environment, when you're in charge of someone else's livelihood, when you're in charge of their paycheck, their health insurance, making sure that they can provide for their family, like it's not actually about me as a leader, it's about them. And it's about our goals and our bottom line. So my job is not to be myself. My job is to be my best self in service of the team and what we're trying to accomplish. Sometimes that means shutting up. Sometimes that means careful curation. That doesn't mean being fake. That means being intentional. I think that is sort of the overarching thesis of what I call responsible authenticity, is to be the version of yourself that helps your team get things done. There's a difference between that and just being a robot.
You quote Tina Fey, who says, authenticity is dangerously expensive. You have to be yourself, but strategically. So, you know, without being fake, how do you, is it just a matter of putting limits on the your part of yourself that you allow to be seen? I mean, is it a ten, is there a, there is a tension there, isn't there, between
Totally.
really being yourself and hiding some of it.
It's being yourself with boundaries. And I think that is one of the guiding words that I come back to throughout the book so many times is that you have to have really strong boundaries. You know, I think about my own personal Instagram account, for example. If someone follows me on Instagram, they are getting the real me. You know, I post about the books I read, a lot of romance novels that maybe my mother-in-law finds kind of confusing. I post about the work that I do. I post about New York City. I'm a mom of two little kids. Those kids are the most important thing in the world to me. You will never see my kids on my Instagram account. Never. That doesn't mean that they're not important or that it's not a huge part of who I am, but that is a boundary I have set. Does that make that version of myself on the internet any less real? No, of course not. It's just a way in which I need to keep careful control over both my kids, you know, they're not consumption for social media, but also keeping a really clear definition between who I am as a leader and who I am as a person. And I think that distinction between person and persona, you know, the goal is for them to be as close to each other as possible, but you actually don't want them to be the same thing. Because if they are, the criticism you're going to get as a leader, which every leader gets criticism, even the most popular leader gets criticized, can consume you from the inside if you don't have a little bit of distance.
When you make that calculation, that decision to, for example, leave your kids off your Instagram account.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of reasons to do that. Unfortunately, some of them have to do with personal security and safety. But is it something that you say, well, if I did put them on my Instagram account, it would show a side of me that would be advantageous to me as a leader? I mean, are you giving up something? Is it a zero sum kind of thing?
It's not exactly zero sum, but it's definitely, you know, with every choice, there are things that advance your goals and things that undermine them. You think, again, if we come back to the example of me putting my kids on the internet, it would for sure grow my platform. If I posted my kids are so beautiful. If I posted them on the internet, of course they would go viral. Like, parenthood is a very a sticky thing on the internet. And I know that the boundary I need to set for myself is such that that's the choice I'm willing to make. I talk with a lot of the leaders who would explain, like, how do they participate in group situations at work? Like, what social Slack channels do they participate in? And a few gave me very concrete advice here, which I've also found to be true myself, is like, pick a couple topics. Maybe it's books, maybe it's sports, maybe it's Taylor Swift, maybe it's your kids, whatever it might be. Focus your social chat on those and the ways in which you engage interpersonally with others on those. That doesn't mean you have to talk about everything or be chit-chatty about everything, but to have really clear boundaries about the ways that you engage with people, it's so powerful. And I think the word power is really important here, because you have to remember, as the leader, the power dynamic between you and the people you manage is never equal. So you have to be really thoughtful about how much of yourself you're burdening them with. One person I talked to told me about, they had a boss before, a boomer boss, who unloaded on them about his mental health challenges. He was like, I think he was trying to show me that it was okay to be falling apart. And on the one hand, I appreciated that. But on the other hand, it made me feel like it was my problem to solve. And that's not a fair responsibility to put on your employee.
And when it comes to social media, we're going to take a quick break and we'll talk more about this on the other side. But it is a given for you that you need to be on social media. In other words, not being on social media isn't an option. Do I have that fairly right?
I think it's an option, but it's one that leaves real things on the table for you. So I think it's a choice you have to make, not something you do accidentally.
All right. We'll talk about how to do it unaccidentally on the other side of a quick break with Amanda Lipman. The new book is called When We're in Charge, The Next Generation's Guide to Leadership. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, Baltimore City Council President Zeke Cohen talks about police accountability in light of several police-involved shootings recently that have led to the tragic deaths of people experiencing mental health crises. And we'll talk about the overdose crisis that took place in West Baltimore earlier this month. Plus, the economist Dr. Richard Clinch of Johns Hopkins assesses the economic impact on Baltimore as billions of research dollars are cut from local budgets. So that's on the way tomorrow. And if you've just joined us today, my guest is Amanda Lipman. We're talking about her terrific new book, When We're in Charge, The Next Generation's Guide to Leadership. You are welcome to join us. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. So when it comes to being online, we were talking about that a little bit just before the break. You say that folks have to determine what they're trying to accomplish online. What should you be trying to accomplish online as a leader?
I think you have to decide if your work is served by you telling your own story. You know, in the same way that in the old offices of yore, you could hang things up in your cubicle or have pictures on the wall of your corner office, whatever it might be. You know, your social media presence is that equivalent. What do you want it to tell? Like, do you know that your colleagues or the people that report to you are going to Google you? They're going to find you on Instagram or on social media, wherever you are. What do you want them to see? What version of you do they want to get? I write in the book, like, even if you assume that you're so locked down that no one can ever find you, I promise you someone can find you. You're never as locked down as you think you are. It is really, I think, missing an opportunity to tell your own story if you are not doing it online. If you don't, someone else will, and they might not tell a story you would like.
And you also say you can turn the question around and say what kind of content and what platforms would undermine your goals. So you have to be, as you say, strategic about not just what you post, but where you post. And, there has to be a goal-oriented motivation in every instance. Give us an idea of an example of a platform that could undermine your goal if you're a particular leader in a particular sector.
Let's say that you are a principal of a school. And the social media platform you've chosen or that you are an active on is Reddit. And actually, you participate in some Reddit threads that maybe you wouldn't want your teammates to see. that stuff is public. Everything on the internet is public. Similarly, who you follow on Instagram is public. Maybe you don't want them to know like a particular news interest of you or the good your Goodreads account, like what books you read. Maybe you don't care, but maybe you do. I think being really thoughtful about it. Again, this is kind of like responsible authenticity. I'm not saying there's a right or wrong answer. There are only answers that are intentional, and then there are answers that are haphazard, and you don't want it to be haphazard.
You give an example of a woman named Tiara Mack, who is a Gen Z Black lesbian Southerner. She moved to Rhode Island. She went to college there, and she stuck around after graduation. And she posted an 8-second clip, so not very long, but an 8-second clip. She was wearing a yellow bikini. She was upside down doing a handstand, and she was twerking on a beach. And she ends this with a smile, and she looks in the camera and says, "Vote Senator Mac." So evidently she was one of the people who had run for something. Were you helping her out for her candidacy? So and then you say it hit the fan once that happened. So
So Tiara is a state senator in Rhode Island. She's an amazing young leader. She ran against a Democratic incumbent, forget when, 2018 or 2020, specifically because it was an anti-choice, anti-gay incumbent. She took him on. She won. She held office. She did amazing stuff for renters, especially for affordable housing across the state. When she ran for re-election, she was using social media. She posted this video. And it got picked up by Tucker Carlson. It got picked up by Fox News. It went viral across the far right internet. She got harassed. She got doxxed. She was getting racist, sexist attacks and threats to her life in her inbox. It was very dangerous. It was very overwhelming. And I think what Tiara said to me later was that it also broke through, like the content itself, especially if this was now 4 years ago, 3 years ago. She was like, it broke through. It like reached people who might not have otherwise heard about my re-election campaign. And that has value. She told me the people for whom it was for got it, and the people who were never going to get it didn't get it and found it confusing. It didn't undermine her goals. I think the backlash was maybe a little bit unexpected, but she is authentically herself online. And I think the way in which she shows up is the same way that she shows up as a leader, which is that she is not interested in the existing preconceived notions of what it means to be a politician.
Amanda Lipman, the book is called When We're in Charge, The Next Generation's Guide to Leadership. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Let's go to the phones to Donna, who's on the line. Donna, welcome to the show with Amanda Lipman.
Hi, how you doing today?
We're doing great. What's on your mind?
And enjoying your show. I have a question for Ms. Lipman. I am a tail end baby boomer. They called us the Generation Jones. And I grew up, I mean, I grew up in the work world where it was extremely, very aggressive, damaging to your self-esteem. The leadership, it wasn't leadership, it was more of managing. And I ended up retiring from my government job. And with that, with that extremism of how I was born in the working field. So I got a part-time job working with adults, disabled adults, and I'm working with the population you're talking about, which your book is talking about. And it was so different, just totally different because I was raised in an environment, a work environment that was extremely just toxic. And I had to learn using the newer generation to step back and not be so, damaged. Because I was damaged by it. I mean, you still have flashbacks. But I just wanted to know how would your book help those of us who are, some baby boomers are still working, and I call myself the talent baby, and the Gen Xers who are getting ready to retire. How does your book help us if we want to, when we go back into the work world with a different generation? And I'll definitely hang up and listen. Thanks so much for your show.
Thanks for that question, Don. I appreciate it. What do you think, Amanda?
Oh, one, thank you so much for acknowledging that. That must have been so challenging and such a jarring re-entry into the work world. You know, I think my book would be really helpful for you to understand what that new leadership style looks like, how to do it differently in a way that treats people compassionately and humanely and still gets things done. You know, I think one of the things I get at a bunch in the book is the same way that millennial and to a certain extent Gen Z parents are trying to do it differently than our parents to try and, you know, break the generational curse in many ways, generational cycles of, you know, and you use the word traumatized or very hard, like, we don't want to do it necessarily the way that our parents did or that the bosses we had before us did. We're doing the same thing in the workplace. So I hope my book will give you some really clear tactics and sort of self-examination to do to help you think about how you can show up as yourself in this new moment and to really understand what the millennial and Gen Z employees are demanding of you. Because one of the challenges of next generation leadership is we're managing our peers. And man, do millennials and Gen Z want something totally different out of the workplace.
And when it comes to managing those peers, you say your goal as a leader is not to provide for every possible want or need. Your goal is to create psychological and emotional safety within reason in order to serve the organization's goal and give people their dignity. Expand on that a little bit.
You know, I think it's really important to be clear, though, a workplace in particular is an economic transaction first and foremost. It is a place in which the employer gives the employee money and in the United States healthcare benefits and hopefully other like fair compensation and wages and benefits in order to provide for their livelihood. That is at bare minimum. And there are other things that the workplace can provide. It can provide dignity, it can provide meaning, it can provide a certain amount of social life, it can provide some amount of physical or mental health benefits. It cannot be the only place where you get a social life. It cannot be the place that you are looking to solve your mental health crisis. It cannot be the place where you have all of your political or civic engagement. Work is like not the right container for that. But I think with the demise of third spaces, with the expansive isolation crisis, you know, with COVID too, which sent everyone home, where work was often their only social engagement, it got really messy. And I think a lot of workplaces tried to overpromise and then couldn't deliver because they weren't the right places to do it. So my onus is to, or my ask is for bosses right now to be so clear about what you can and can't provide and to hold those boundaries firmly. Because I think the greatest source of frustration from anyone, but especially from employees, is the disconnect between expectations and reality. Carefully manage expectations and make sure they meet reality. People may not always like what you can deliver, but at the very least, they cannot say they were misunderstood or misled.
That brings up the tension between sort of dictating what people can do in their lives. I mean, the example of being online, you talked about what the boss has to keep in mind when she's online. But is it appropriate, advisable, morally okay to dictate what employees can put online or not? I mean, are you in a position as a leader to say, look, because you work here, we don't want you putting A, B, C, D, and E online? Or does that cross a red line?
I think it depends on the nuances of where you work and what you do. I do think that it is fair to say that there are codes of conduct, and that especially if your workplace is listed in your profile in any way, that it could in politics, we often say don't post anything you wouldn't want on the front page of the New York Times. The same is true, I think, for a lot of circumstances. I think it is really incumbent, in fact, on the individual in this case, to post like a leader, something I often say, You don't want to undermine your workplace either, your goals, your career goals. Being more intentional, whether you're in charge or not, about what you put on the internet will serve you. Yes, you can delete things, but the internet is forever.
Yes, as many people find out on a
Learn the
daily
hard
basis.
way.
Yeah, the very hard way. You write that it'll feel counterintuitive, but you have to plan for spontaneity and synchronicity. One of the chapters that I found myself screaming, no, when I read was your affection for using icebreakers. You say you're a big fan of icebreakers in meetings and stuff. Those, for me personally, drive me nuts. But why do you think icebreakers and that kind of thing, that kind of planned activity, can be productive and can advance the goals?
Especially in Zoom or like virtual remote work environments, you need to create the space for the kind of small talk that happens naturally in a conference room. I know that they are silly. I know that they are cheesy. And it is, I think, a really important way to level set at the beginning of a meeting. You never know what's happening right before a call starts, especially in a remote work environment. Like maybe they were just dealing with a crying kid or an aging parent, or maybe they just had to like clean up a pile of dog poop, or maybe they just had a really tough work session right before this, or they're in a really good mood. An icebreaker allows everyone to start the meeting at the same place or to enter the meeting in the same way. It also creates some containers for the kind of small talk that you need to happen to help smooth over the personal relationships. It is cheesy. It's all a little cheesy. It's a little earnest. It's a little cringe. And I think earnesty and cringe can be nice. I think it can be fun. I also think it can help rebalance the power dynamic. I have a friend who's an expert facilitator, someone Danielle Cantor, who often says one of her goals of a meeting is that everyone speaks at least once. And an icebreaker is a way to guarantee that everyone speaks at least once, sort of breaks the seal so that the next time you talk, it's not the first time you've spoken up in the space.
Yeah, and I think, certainly there's a big difference between having a Zoom meeting and having a meeting around a table in a conference room. So I certainly understand in that context. When you talk about being inclusive of people and, supportive and empathetic and compassionate, you say you need to be just a little bit exclusive in order to be inclusive. So what are you talking about there?
To create a work environment or a team environment that is welcoming to people of all different types of backgrounds, of all types of experiences, of different races, classes, genders, sexual orientations, and the like, you need to keep the bigots and the racists and the sexists out. I think I use maybe sharper language in the book there, but you need to be really careful to set a boundary of what kind of behavior you will not tolerate in service of that inclusive, welcoming space. That can often feel really counterintuitive, but it is so important because if you do not penalize and quickly punish or hold accountable people who cross the line, it no longer becomes an inclusive and equitable space, and it undermines everything you're trying to do. And I think it is unfortunately needs to be said in 2025 that inclusivity, equity, diversity, they are both moral goods. They are also business imperatives. They're good for your bottom line. We have seen this on the grandest scale with as Target has gone, stepped away from their pledges to DEI, their profit numbers have gone down. As Costco has doubled down on them, their profit numbers have gone up. We see this in over and over and over again in business research, political science research, and others. Diverse teams, when managed well, perform well. It is important. It is also going to become a lived reality. You ask younger folks about DEI, and they're like, I don't understand what you're talking about because, any group of people under the age of like 20 is inherently a diverse group because their generations are more and more diverse. Racial identities, especially, have gotten more and more messy, and I think a good way, but also a complicated way, as folks have gotten younger. So you got to do it. You should do it. And you should do it in a way that holds a really clear boundary about what you could do and do not accept as appropriate behavior.
Another quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about another flag that you raise consistently in this book, and that is for the 4-day work week. You've got a lot of compatriots in that particular aspiration. The book is When We're in Charge, The Next Generation's Guide to Leadership. The author is my guest, Amanda Lipman. We'll have more with Amanda after a quick break. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Amanda Littman. She's a veteran of political campaigns and the co-founder of Run for Something, an organization that recruits young people and advises them when they run for public office. Amanda Littman has written a book that ventures outside the realm of politics and targets Gen Z and millennials who are leading for-profit and nonprofit organizations. It's a how-to guide for young leaders who are navigating the rapidly changing dynamics of the modern workplace. It's called When We're in Charge, The Next Generation's Guide to Leadership. To be part of our conversation, our number here, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. So, Amanda, you're a big fan of the four-day work week. You say in order to work better, you need to rest better. So it happens that this summer I'm taking every Friday off, and I'm digging it. I got to tell you, it's really great. My wife and I have taken little trips. We've, you know, traveled, and we've done stuff that you can't do in 2 days. So I'm a fan from personal experience, but you think it really is imperative for the future workplace because why? It's going to attract people. It's going to make people ultimately more productive. How do you see it being positive?
All of the above. You know, as a leader and as a person, it is so nice. We've had a four-day work week at Run for Something since full-time since 2022. I haven't worked on a Friday on my Run for Something stuff since then. It rules. And now that I'm a parent, you know, I have two little kids under the age of three, I get to go into the weekend being better rested. I get to be a better parent on Saturdays and Sundays. And anyone with little kids knows those weekends are very long. They're not refreshing when you have tiny children. It is so valuable. It allows me to be more rigorous and forces me to be more rigorous about prioritization across our team. You know, we did a pilot program before we launched it full time. We partnered with 4 Day Global Work Week, which is running a global pilot. And when we asked our staff if they were interested in it, we queried people. And I'll never forget one person in particular was really nervous about it. They were like, I don't know. I think I'm going to have to say no to more stuff at work if I do this. Like, I won't have time to do the things I want to do. I'm ambitious. I want big projects. I want to do a lot of things. Like, one less day at work could make that really hard. And when we revisited it 6 months after the pilot, this person, same person said, the things I have to say no to at work are made up for by the things I get to say yes to outside of it. It has absolutely transformed our relationship to time, to work, to deliverables. Took a little while to get used to, but I think it is possible in more workplaces and more industries than you might think. And I think it is for sure the kind of thing that can really open up people's ability to engage with each other, with their communities, with their friends, with their family. It's also great for recruiting. Basically, every job we post gets hundreds, if not thousands, of resumes.
And is there an expectation that you're going to do 5 days worth of work in 4 days, or that you're going to do 4 days worth of work? You're going to take a day off, you're going to rest, you're going to enjoy all of the, you know, benefits of that, and that, you know, Monday morning comes back again, and then, you know, you just, that's what you've achieved. I mean, does it matter, has it affected your productivity, as they say in corporate America?
We have found that basically every metric we could find to measure productivity when we did the pilot went up, and every metric that measured, you know, exhaustion, anxiety, burnout went down. It definitely forced us to be, again, more rigorous about what we would say yes to and prioritize, which I think is a good thing in most circumstances. And we did have to adjust the timelines. You know, a project that before we could have said will be done by the end of the week, maybe it'll get done the week after on a Tuesday. And that makes us need to be better about planning. I would say the only downside to it is that my meeting schedules are a little bit more jam-packed because you only have 4 days for meetings as opposed to five. But that also forces me to ask every time, should this be a meeting or could this be an email? It is a net good in every possible way. And it is just, it's so refreshing. I will know, every time we have new employees start, they will say, like, it takes me like a month or 6 weeks to get used to this, but I'm never going back.
Let's go to the phones. Christina's on the line in Towson. Christina, welcome to the show with Amanda Littman.
Hi there. I was I know we've heard a lot about the Gen Z stare, and you know what that means, I guess, in work and in other places. How does that affect leadership when we're looking to form rapport, or is that something that people just, you know, present to customers? You know, how do you make relationships and try and lead people when you have a somewhat flat affect and you don't seem to be able to connect? I guess is my big question. We've been hearing a lot about that.
Yeah, we'll post on our website an example of the Gen Z stare. You know, our caller Christina, you know, defines it as a lack of affect. What do you think about that? The Gen Z stare is definitely a thing, isn't it?
You know, I think it's very funny to see it go viral. It's definitely part of this, but I think this is where the onus is on leadership to really be clear about what expectations look like for effective professional environment, like behavior. You know, one of the things I come back to in the book a lot is being really, really clear about what success looks like and what failure looks like, to assume that you have to teach people how to show up in the workplace, you know, especially for people who maybe entered the workplace during COVID. They didn't have that sort of on the ground training. And that you really need to establish communication norms. Like in the same way that you need to tell people, you know, if I send you an email, the expectation is you answer it between X amount of hours after you received it, whatever that norm might be for your workplace. You got to teach people when someone asks you a question, you answer it in an appropriate and professional manner. I do think it's very funny. The videos are very entertaining. And, you know, every generation has their own little quirk.
I'm a terrible sleeper personally, and there are times at 3 o'clock in the morning when I'm up, I'm reading, I'm getting ready for whatever show I'm thinking about, I'll send people an email, but I don't have the expectation that they're going to answer me at 3:30 in the morning. My expectation is that I'll hear from them sometime after 9 o'clock the next day. But are there a lot of people in my generation, the boomer generation, who send these emails at 5:30 in the morning when they're going to the gym and expect to hear by 6 a.m. Is that an expectation you've seen and heard about when you interviewed people for this book?
Totally. And I will say, I'd encourage you to pick up or turn on the scheduling tool on your email on your phone, which you can do. You can schedule emails to be sent a little bit later. I know this is something I've had to personally deal with. You know, you can do your work whenever you want to see fit, but you don't want to make it other people's responsibility to deal with it on your own personal preferences. This is why the onus has to come from leadership to set clear expectations. It's definitely something I heard, like, they expect me to answer emails at 9 p.m. Like, I'm asleep, I'm with my kids, I'm, you know, I'm out with my friends, I'm at the gym, whatever it is. You got to be really clear about what your workplace expectations are and communication norms are. And then model it yourself as the leader. And that's the thing that I think a lot of folks miss as part of this equation, is that you can't just write it in the procedures or tell people to do it. You have to do it too. It's hard. It's really hard, because often the people who rise to the top are the ones who are willing to, like, you know, go the extra mile. You got to hold it back, because if you undermine yourself, if you say, no, don't send emails after 7 p.m., but then you as the boss send emails after 7 p.m., I can't take you seriously.
Fair enough. Let's go to Angela. She's on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Amanda Lippman.
Yes, thank you so much. So I wanted to ask Ms. Lippman, thank you for being on the show, if... what do you think about there being a correlation between this millennial and Generation Z's new approach or different approach to leadership, and any correlation there might be to cooperative businesses? I spoke with the call taker and mentioned just like Red Emma's here in Baltimore, and it really does, cooperatives really do lend themselves to this new leadership style that is more integrative, that's more inclusive. And, you know, I think for a while, Red Emma's even did have like the 4-day work week. And you notice that there's a different feel amongst the co-owners of the business.
That's a terrific question, Angela. I really appreciate it. And Amanda, Red Emma's is a bookstore cafe here in Baltimore, and it's run as a cooperative. So all of the employees own it and run it. How does this leadership style and leadership advice fit into that model?
Oh, I love this question. Thank you for asking it. You know, I talked to a couple of folks who run sort of co-op style workplaces or collaboratively run work environments, and it so perfectly embodies next gen leadership. There's definitely some challenges that come into it around scale, around emotional dynamics, you know, around giving feedback in those environments. And a couple of the folks I spoke to named those, but you know, to a T, each one said it was a real value add to how they were able to work as a team. And that they had to be forced to even more clarity about how they interact with each other. And I think that gets to one of the bigger themes of next generation leadership, which is unbelievable amounts of clarity. The more clear you can be, the more transparent you can be, the more on the level you can be, the better, because it allows people to understand how to engage with each other. I know it sounds like really maybe surprising to folks that millennials and Gen Z like want more rules or want more guidelines, but that kind of structure allows you to know how to do it well. And what we really want is to succeed.
Yeah, of course. And at the very end of the book, in the acknowledgments, you acknowledge that the year 2024 was really tough for your organization, for Run for Something. And you said that you had to restructure the organization. I assume that means you had to let some people go. And that's never easy. It's never fun. And it's a terrible thing to have to go through for any manager or leader. How does this new approach to leadership, you know, inform those kinds of executing on those kinds of you know, evidently necessary plans.
Yeah, you know, I write in the book about the layoffs that Run for Something had to do both in the beginning of 2024 and then again as part of a broader restructure right at the end. And that I'm not the victim of this story. I always want to be really clear. The people who lost their jobs are and always will be the victims of this process. And it was really hard. And it should always be really hard. I'm always dubious of any executive or boss who treats firing or layoffs or any of the like as like it's easy. It shouldn't be. It should weigh on you. It should make you feel bad. And you should arm yourself with the integrity to know that you are making the right decision for the care for the whole, even if that does cause some harm for care for the individual. It is so hard to be in a leadership position in any environment, especially right now with so much instability, with so much economic uncertainty, with so much political chaos. So, you know, I think that experience, the course of working on this book while I was going through that in my own workplace. Also, I wrote the book while pregnant and I had a one-year-old. It was a rough year.
Yeah, very rough year. Well, you do say that a lot of boomer leaders don't see any issue with calling their employees a family. But you say, look, if you can fire me, you are not my family. That's absolutely true. Well, you know, it's been great talking to you about this book, Amanda. I really appreciate it. I enjoyed reading it. Lots of stuff to think about. So good luck with it. And thanks for your time today. I'm grateful.
Thanks for having me, and thanks to your thoughtful callers.
Amanda Lippman. The book is When We're in Charge, The Next Generation's Guide to Leadership. And that's it for us today. Tomorrow, I'll check in with Baltimore City Council President Zeke Cohen and Dr. Richard Clinch, an economist at Johns Hopkins University. And up next, it's Fresh Air. It's coming after news at the top of the hour. Today, the guest is the journalist Joseph Lee. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for subscribing to our podcast. Have a great day.
You're tuned to 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.